Hello and welcome to another edition of Radio at Firehouse.com. My name is Peter Matthews, and I am the assistant editor here at Firehouse. And I would like to thank you for joining us today in the first of a four-part series on firefighter assistance grants, primarily the assistance to firefighter grants put out by the FEMA. This year, the opening was on March 6th, and the deadline for the program is April 7th, and in this four-part series, we're going to work with Brian Vickers, our key correspondent on grants, to try and help departments better themselves, to get the money that's out there, and hopefully we can push along a lot of departments to actually put in for grants so we can add money to the pool that they put out each year. Brian Vickers is a member of the fire service for more than 12 years, and is currently an EMT and engineer with the Community Volunteer Fire Department in Houston, Texas, where he previously served in roles as district captain and department training officer. Brian holds a bachelor's degree in Communication Information Systems Management and is also pursuing a master's in business administration with a concentration in e-business. Brian is also a full-time employee as a senior programmer and analyst at Land Data Systems Incorporated in Houston, Texas. On the side, Brian's a freelance grant writer and fire service consultant. His grant information website is a free resource for anybody who's trying to use it and learn more about the grants. You can learn more about Brian's grant business at firegraphics.org. That's www.firegraphics.org. If you have any questions for Brian, you can also email him at any time at brianb@firegraphics.org. Today's presentation is proudly sponsored by Plumevent. Plumevent is a driving force in advancing firefighter health and safety. Plumevent's diesel exhaust removal system features 100% source capture to eliminate all diesel exhaust from the firehouse, as stated in the NFPA 1500 standard. Plumevent diesel exhaust removal systems meet the requirements stated in the Fire Act grant program guidance for modifications to facilities. Please visit plumevent.com. That's PLYMOVENT.com, or click on the link on this page to learn more about their exhaust removal systems. Thank you to Plumevent, and thank you to Brian. Brian, let's get started.
Brian, I don't know if you heard, but a few weeks ago, we put together a podcast with some of the members of the DHS who are administrating the Assistance to Firefighter Grants Program, including Brian Cohen, who's the director of the program. Did you get a chance to listen to that?
Yes, I listened to it in its entirety. It was definitely nice to hear from them, from the guys that are running the program, and get their perspective on what's going on with the grant programs and things they see that can be improved. And it was nice to hear, and a lot of the people I talked to that listened to it, it was nice to hear from them to tell everyone else that they are trying to make improvements to the program, and they have been making improvements to the program ever since its inception. It hasn't just been a static set of guidelines or priorities. They've been listening to the fire service on what's been needed and trying to make improvements. Some of the ones that's been recommended is trying to get the word out there. Nearly every year, almost a third of the fire departments in the country don't even apply because they don't know about the program. A lot of it is internet-based. The information about the grant program and the priorities, and certainly the application now since 2002, has been online. With less than 60% of the households in the country having internet access, it's certainly hard for these departments to get that information out there. And they're certainly making efforts. It was nice to hear Chief Gaines on there saying they're trying to make an attempt to personally contact a lot of the departments through letters and phone calls and ask them why they haven't applied, or if they knew about the program or what they could do. They've certainly increased the number of workshops. I believe they're up to 450 this year in all areas of the country to try and get the word out. And they're certainly free, and a lot of good information detailed in there. So it was nice to hear from DHS's perspective that, and let everybody know that they are making the efforts to get the word out there and get everybody involved.
Okay, Brian, thanks. At the Firehouse World Conference in San Diego in late February, the people from the Assistance to Firefighter Grants Program were actually there to give a free workshop for this year's program, and it was very well attended. It's really good to see that they're out going everywhere they can to help get the word out and let people know it is there. Brian, what problems do you encounter the most when you are out there trying to help departments to get the grants? I know that the DHS offers the Fire Support, I'm sorry, firegrantsupport.com website, their help desk email, and their 800 number. What common problems are you encountering time and time again?
A lot of it is some of the most common problems I see. Actually, the most common problem is not even reading the guidance materials at all. I've seen a lot of applications put in for ineligible projects, and a lot of them by ineligible applicants. I mean, it certainly doesn't. It's not a very simple thing to churn out a grant application. You need a lot of information and things, and so it's a few hours involvement. And certainly, it's a disappointment to get a denial. But when it was somebody who put in all their hard work and whoever they were applying for wasn't eligible in the first place. And that's something that's detailed right up front in the program guidance documents that are available on that website and in the frequently asked questions section as well. A lot of departments applied, for instance, county fire departments, where the county owns every fire station. They're all county employees. They can only submit one application. But several have put some in, one for each station. When that happens, they throw out all of them, when they could have certainly had one and had a viable project. But unfortunately, without reading the guidance, everything goes out the window. Recently in the fire prevention program, there was a for-profit company that applied. And it also details right in the guidance that the for-profit companies are not eligible here either. I've seen several station edition applications people tried to put in, or actually they put in, of course, got denied. Other major ones are people applying for cell phones and two-way pagers, which basically anything that has a monthly contract associated with it isn't considered a communications device for emergency services, so those aren't eligible. And several other ones I got with the recent addition of EMS agencies and rescue squads was I've seen a lot of body armor projects be put in. And very plainly it states in the guidance that tactical body armor is not an eligible project. And some of them are just overboard. Some people that want everything for everybody, individual radios for the entire department or even individual self-contained breathing apparatus for all firefighters, and that's beyond what it states in the guidance, where you can ask for basically one SCBA per seat and one radio per seat. And being going into the sixth year of the program, they're not being as lenient as they have been in the past. Basically, anything that's ineligible gets the entire application thrown out. And we see a lot, even those people that do read the guidance, we've all got something that makes us human, which is bias or experience or culture. We tend to read things, if we read them quickly and we don't read them objectively, we find the points that are going to help us do what we want to do. And a lot of people will read something in the guidance and say, well, you know, that says it's a higher priority. And they say, you know, they read that as, it wasn't a higher priority than something else, but that it's a high priority in the first place. And that's not the case with several items. And they include those in there. They may have had a viable case for some other items and high priority items that were in their request, but by asking for too many low priority items, it'll bring their score down and possibly enough that they get denied and won't be getting any money. There's a lot of different tips and tricks in there as we go along, but the easiest part is to read it with a clear mind, and that way we get the objective point of view. And it's kind of tough. Certainly, we wait till the last minute and go to read something. We have to read it fast, and we only read certain sections of it, and that's when mistakes happen. And most of them, especially when we get down to the narrative portion of the grant, people aren't addressing what it's being asked for. And the biggest issue people have in explaining is their funding issues. And it's not something where you have to have a small budget or you know rich departments don't all get the grants and poor departments don't all get the grants. It's certainly easy to explain when you have a $25,000 a year budget that you can't afford $150,000 or even $200,000 fire engine. But what they still want to hear is that you're not spending only $2,000 a year and putting $23,000 in savings. Everybody has to account for what they're doing with whatever money they have. And some people try and hide that, you know, they have large apparatus payments because they've taken, you know, they had to replace their own apparatus, and, you know, they replaced 20-year-old, 30-year-old trucks, and now they've got a major debt service there. And they try and hide that fact, but when you have a large budget, that makes it look like you have a whole lot of excess funding laying around. And it's actually better to say that, hey, we saw a problem. We, you know, we needed a new truck. We needed, you know, we had the money. We financed it. We expected growth in the area. That didn't happen. Our revenues hadn't increased. And now we haven't been able to take on this project. It's a whole lot better to say and to show that you're making some kind of local effort to help yourselves. And now you've hit on a situation, whatever problem you're applying for, and you just can't afford it at this point. And that's okay. That happens with every single fire department in the country. But the people that have been successful repeatedly have found that point, and they've explained that, you know, we've done as much as we can on our own, and there just isn't any money left. And also, a lot of people don't show any effort to change their funding situation. Some people just say, well, we don't have time to fundraise, or we don't feel like fundraising. And certainly, in some areas, your call volume is too high that you can't get out there and fundraise. Or, you know, especially in a volunteer environment with the amount of training and things like that, you know, family is important, and you just can't expect everyone to be at the station, you know, 40, 50 hours a week trying to raise funding. So you still have to show some effort to say, well, we're trying to get some kind of tax rate passed or increase that funding or increase awareness or even applying for other grant programs. There's numerous grant programs out there besides the Assistance of Firefighters grant program. You know, Department of Forestry has some, Housing and Urban Development, even some private foundations. And saying that you go to these other locations to look for funding is also a good thing to mention. It doesn't matter if you get awards from them or not, but at least you're making the effort, and you're letting everyone know that you are making that effort. And of course, certainly some people disagree with what the priorities of the program are, and they decide that they're just going to apply for whatever they want, whatever I need. And certainly, you know, in some areas it may be a priority of what you want in your specific area, but this grant program is aimed to be a national program and take in the general high-level needs of most of the departments in this country. And not many people realize that this program was built on an FPA study that was done back in the early and mid-1990s, and then again updated in 2002, which stated that, of course, some of the things were very obvious, like if you're an urban department and have high hydrant coverage, then you don't need a tanker because your water supply problems have been solved already. Same reason with the rural department. Tall aerial ladders over 76 feet are not a priority because definition of a rural department is you really don't have a whole lot of tall buildings in your area. And there's other situations like that that if you don't really read the guidance documents and get in there and understand what the program's trying to fund and why it's trying to fund certain things, you can't really tailor your application to answer all the questions that they're looking for. And some of this comes from a lot of departments don't perform any kind of assessment of their needs. Someone just decides, well, we need new bunker gear. You know, ours is 4 or 5 years old. We just need new stuff. And they don't really look at, you know, what the program's looking to fund. And a lot of keywords like old, worn, and things like that, non-NFPA compliant. And certainly your gear may be worn within a couple years. It's certainly possible depending on certain call volumes. But without performing an assessment saying, okay, well, maybe there's something else that might be important. A lot of people trying for vehicles thinking that's their only, you know, this is their only hope for funding a truck. But they're sending people in with SCBA and PPE that's 15, 20 years old, and that's really the risk to injury. And that's why, you know, equipment gets more money than the vehicles do, because, you know, we ride in the fire truck to the scene, and then we get out, and we actually put ourselves at risk fighting the fire interior. You know, and at that point, you know, that's the real risk to the lives. I mean, certainly a lot of people have been injured and killed by vehicle accidents, but you know, the actual risk in being a firefighter is having protective equipment. And if you know, we don't read the priorities and realize that, you know, and take a good look at the department, you know, that we're running with and seeing, you know, where our safety risks are and what are our operational risks and what can we actually do to change that. And of course, some departments don't do anything in terms of the prerequisites. This year, being compliant with the National Incident Management System. By October 1st of 2005, we had to have IS 700 introductory, the NIMS course, completed. And of course, in order to be eligible by the time the award comes around. With this year, we need to finish the next two levels by October 1st, or we won't be compliant and be able to apply next year. And some just refuse actually to report to NFIRS as well, the National Fire Incident Reporting System, because they want to, you know, USFA keeps statistics on fire calls and where the dangers are and help create other programs to possibly address those situations. And if we decide not to report to those programs, they won't have the research to build upon. And certainly, if the federal government is going to hand you money, it's really not a big issue to give them a couple statistics that they need, and they'll give you the money.
Brian, do the departments that apply for the grant program have to prove their incident numbers and their responses in order to apply?
Yes. After one of the questions, if you're in line for award, is whether or not you if report to NFIRS already, or if you don't, if you would, if they gave you the award. And it's not very hard to set up. I mean, you go through your state fire marshal's office in most cases, and there's some software or paper applications, depending on your situation, whether or not you can get online. And it helps build, you know, future programs to see what the risks are. Certainly surveys have been sent out a couple times as well. I said for designing the priorities, that NFPA study. They sent out almost 25,000 surveys, and only about 12,000 came back. And in that case, it's kind of like, you know, the election for president. If you didn't vote, you really can't complain about who's in office because you didn't take part. You know, you were invited to take part in the election, and you didn't. This was the same way. You know, departments were asked, what are your needs? And if you didn't answer anything, then I guess the answer was we really didn't need anything.
You talk about the surveys that the AFG have put out in the past and the value of their priorities. I guess in this manner, departments, whether they are rural or urban, are not judged based on what's all around the country. It's just based on their district levels. Is that correct?
Yes, it does vary by classification and by department type, as you mentioned. Certainly rural departments, by definition, of course, have water supply issues. And the vehicle matrix is built entirely upon the stereotypical situations that each would run into. Suburban departments, of course, are caught between urban and rural. They were rural 10, 20 years ago, and now they're starting to get built up, and now they're getting some tall buildings. So for suburban, aerial devices are a higher priority than they are for rural. And, of course, in urban setting, urban is the only classification that has a rescue truck as a priority one vehicle, because urbans are going to have higher density housing. They may be, you know, a higher risk of terrorist attack or a building collapse with mass casualty, and you'll need a heavier rescue unit. And of course, in training as well, that's also split. In rural areas where the risks may not be as high for technical rescue situations or even hazardous material situations, the priorities for training in rural departments really goes to the basics. Firefighter 1, Firefighter 2, and driver operator, and a lot of the basic firefighting skills. As you go in through suburban into urban, of course, they're expected to have the basics already, and their higher priorities go for the technical rescue and the hazmat. And the same thing goes for the equipment to support those training objectives.
What about in a larger playing field, Brian? For example, trying to secure money for a county hazmat truck. Is there a section in the grant to secure something for a countywide use, or is it just on a local individual department level? Do you know if there's anything for the countywide level?
They have had regional programs since year one, but they've modified them this year. Basically, it's either training, equipment, or communications are the only eligible categories for regional. They won't support a regional vehicle application, of course, because it's one vehicle. It's going to be parked in one spot. Even though it would be available for use, it is an individual department that's going to be primarily taking care of that vehicle. And in many cases, it's really only cost-benefit-wise beneficial for those types of applications to go in. If an entire region needs some kind of hazardous materials response team and doesn't have one, then of course it's easier to bring in a few people from every department and have them trained and spread the equipment out across the region, and have some people in every part of the county. Certainly everybody's available to come to any incident, but that way at least you have a few people familiar in every department. And same goes for communications. It's kind of hard to get a high priority with an individual communications application to upgrade your radios, regardless of what band they're on. The key with communications is interoperability. And if you're the only one that's going to be upgrading your system, then it's kind of hard to explain how that's interoperable with everyone else around you. And equipment-wise, if it makes a lot of sense, and you know, if you're regularly automatic mutual aid with several departments in your area, to have common equipment, whether it be air packs or cascade systems and things like that. So that way, regardless of the size of the incident, everybody's got similar equipment and everybody's familiar with it.
Brian, during the judging process, do the AFG personnel look through the department books? I mean, as far as do they look to see if they keep an accurate record of where the tax and donation monies are coming from and going to? Is it very critical? And I guess, does the AFG do an audit of their own?
They have been coming more and more out to audit. There have been several mistakes found and several pieces of equipment taken away from departments for not following the rules or not following the bidding regulations, whether they be the federal or local. It depends on your area. DHS requires a request. You request at least two bids for whatever you're trying to purchase with the federal monies. If your local area requires more than that, they require three or four or whatever the specific bidding rules is, you have to follow those as well. Another requirement, of course, is you can't alter your budget for 3 years. So you can't say, well, you know, we got that truck that we were saving up for, so we've been saving $10,000 a year or whatever the amount of money is. You can't suddenly say, oh, good, we're going to take that money and go use it somewhere else. Your line items in your budget have to stay static for at least 3 years, because the grant program isn't really meant to be a fix-all for every problem you have. It's meant to support and enhance whatever operations you have in progress. So, of course, they don't want you to take any savings you have and blow it on some other project and then not be able to afford something else and be dependent on the next year's grant program or a couple years down the road dependent on the grant program for it. And it also helps in a lot of cases because some municipal departments, of course, try and take that route and move the funding out of the fire department's budget, saying, well, you got that grant, so you don't need this money anymore. So it does help save departments in some cases, but it hurts some other departments as well.
All right, Brian, well, thank you very much for the first part of this here. Again, I just wanted to say thank you for being here today. For the first part, the four-part series will also include another day of some more information on the grants and what people are doing right, wrong, and how to better ourselves for the program coming up. And that's going to be followed up by a bunch of success stories. In the third part, we're going to talk to some departments who have won. Many of them thought they would never actually get the money, but in the end they've gotten it, and one is a success story that you really have to listen to.
This presentation is proudly sponsored by Plimovent. Plimovent is a driving force in advancing firefighter health and safety. Plimovent's diesel exhaust removal systems feature 100% source capture to eliminate all diesel exhaust from the firehouse, as stated in NFPA 1500. Plimovent diesel exhaust removal systems meet the requirements stated in the Fire Act Grant Program guidance for modifications to facilities. Visit plimovent.com or click on the link on this page to learn more about their exhaust removal systems.
Brian, getting back to the program, is there anything that a member submitting a grant can take from the guidance sheets that could really kind of put them ahead? How about something that one department will do to kind of top all of the departments that are applying?
A lot of it is what they're actually asking for in some cases. So we do, a lot of departments will go through a couple of the sections, and other than vehicles, you can apply for several of the other categories. You can apply for bunker gear, air packs, radios, health and safety equipment, all within one application. Vehicle is the only time that you can apply for one thing, and the only exception there, of course, is you can, if you don't have the equipment to make the truck and FPA 1901 compliant, you can include monies to within the project to purchase all that equipment. But a lot of departments will go down and they'll say, well, you know, we need, in three different categories, we meet the priorities for all three of these things. And they'll ask for all three of those things at the same time. And what we also heard in the podcast with Mr. Cowan, Mr. Harrington, and Mr. Gaines was that when you do something like that, you essentially do have to write three different narratives, because you have to justify why you need each of those projects, because they are completely different projects, and also why you can't afford each of those projects on their own, and of course you need a cost benefit for each piece. And we start to go at that point, we're pushing the limit on the maximum amount of pages that they'll include in the narrative. Some departments, even within one category, are asking for a lot of things. I mean, I've seen some departments ask for something as simple as a few shovels and rakes. You know, when you've got an application for $100,000 worth of bunker gear and air packs, saying you can't really afford a couple $20 shovels or anything really doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because the assumption is when you're making this application, even if as a rural department, if you got a 5% match on a $100,000 project, you're basically saying you have $5,000 available to match this grant if you were given the award. But then to turn around in the project and say, well, we've got $5,000, but we really can't afford these $20 shovels and rakes, really doesn't speak to you've done a good job in designing your project and defining your actual needs. And a lot of people within that, I mean, they may go for bunker gear, and bunker gear is the highest priority piece of equipment, but then throwing in something else that isn't a high priority can dilute your score. The way they calculate your score in each section is based on the dollar amount going to each specific project. So if 90% of the money you're asking for is for bunker gear, and maybe 10% of it is going for a four-gas meter for hazardous materials and confined space, that's not a very high priority item. So what they'll do is weight your score based on 90% and 10%. And with this 20,000 applications a year and maybe only 5,000 awards, this is a game of fractions. That little bit of a drop from that 10% asking for that low priority item can move you right out of the scoring zone.
Brian, what can you give me numbers-wise on the AOG program? The first year, the amount of money that was being offered was greater than it is actually now. Is there any way to help establish the same amount of money the first year, year after year, or is it going to continue to be reduced, or does that change each year? And what about the number of applicants, just to kind of give us an idea of what an applicant could be going up against in the long run?
Every year since basically 2003, they've been over 20,000 applications. The first couple years, of course, the first year there was only $100 million, and being a new grant program, not that many people knew about it. Myself, I only found out about it about 3 weeks before the application period opened. But since then, they've certainly gotten the word out there. But for the last 3 years, it's averaged just over 20,000 applications, and that's where we find that, you know, almost 10,000 to 12,000 departments don't apply every year. And even more departments have been finding out about the program and applying, but some departments that have applied in the past are no longer applying. Some of them get frustrated with it. They make a lot of the common mistakes that we've highlighted so far. And it's just, we need to increase that. It's kind of hard to build the need for more funding. The awards have actually gone down and gotten more competitive, not because of more applications, but just basically because there's less money available. In 2003, it was funded at $750 million, and same with 2004. And this past year, it went down to $650 million, and this year we're looking at $500. You know, it's very important that departments, you know, spend a little bit of time and put in an application. know, try and do the best we can with it. It doesn't have to be professionally done or anything like that. I mean, we need to get out there and really just put the applications in and make everyone realize that, yes, there still is a need. As the application numbers stay static, certainly as the money drops, the number of awards are going to go down, and we're not going to prove to anyone that the fire service is still underfunded. So it is, you know, it is highly important that we at least apply. But within that, like you said, it is getting more competitive because of less money. So they're looking closer and closer at each application. And we are going to have to make tighter applications in order to have success with it. We are going to have to drop those low-priority items. You know, what happened in past years is not going to fly in the next year because the competition changed. Basically, every year we expect 5,000 awards or thereabout, and at least probably a quarter of that, just to estimate, out of that 20,000, 5,000 departments are just throwing in Hail Mary applications, as I call them. They're, you know, they're just trying something. They figure it may not work, but they may say yes, so let's try it. So between those 5,000 Hail Marys and the 5,000 awards, when we come up to the next year, we've got at least 10,000 brand new applications coming in with new projects, and they'll go through the computer and score completely different. So the 10,000 in the other pool that may or may not have gotten reviewed or really tried and really did the assessments and did things right, we can't expect that even if we did make it down to peer review and then were denied at that point, that we can expect to put in the same application and get the same results. The players in the game have changed every year, and that has certainly frustrated a lot of people I deal with because they haven't made any modifications year to year. And we can't just expect, as I said, that, you know, the priorities from last year may very well stay the same, but with different people in the game, everyone's score is going to change, and the level at which everything is going to get funded is going to change as well.
Okay, Brian, so if you don't win the grant on the first try and you want to apply again, do the priorities change from year to year? And should you submit the same grant from the previous year if you do want to submit again?
Yes. Even though the guidance really hasn't changed, 99% of it is basically the same since 2001. But as I said, with different players in the game, you really have to look at what did you ask for? Did we really, you know, follow the rules well? Did we explain our issues? You know, why we haven't been able to fund it, where the benefit is, and really go through the assessment process that built that previous application all over again. And there's nothing wrong with coming back to the same conclusion. Certainly as more and more departments are getting educated on what needs to be done through reading articles, seminars, attendance, participating in the forums, listening to podcasts, certainly everyone is getting more and more educated. We are going to get to the point, certainly if the funding decreases, that every application is going to be highly competitive. And then essentially at that point, I believe that truly the program's meeting what its goals were, which is the greatest needs of the fire service are being taken care of at that point. So we really do need to stay on top of our game every year.
With the peer review committee, is it best to leave it in plain English, or should you jazz it up with a little bit of fire jargon? Who exactly is actually looking at the applications during the entire process?
Some of them are. Some of them are. It is a volunteer process to go to peer review, usually coordinated through the state fire marshal's office. Most everyone up there has some familiarity with the fire service, but not everyone was at some point or is a street level firefighter with fire ground experience. And it's kind of tough at some point to back off, and we're used to saying things certain ways and talking amongst ourselves about what, you know, this task force or that task force, and even within the fire service itself. I mean, what's a task force in the northeast part of the country is not going to be a task force in the Midwest or even the West Coast. So we do have to take that little extra time and make sure that, you know, we're explaining it in a way that someone outside the fire service can understand it and see why our needs are, what the needs are, and the way we're defining it. And whatever problem we're defining and what we're coming up with as a solution makes sense.
Brian, with the apparatus replacement and purchase process, how do they go about that? Say your department has three engines and a ladder in service at this time. and you're looking to replace a 1950s model, but it's a third new piece. Can you ask for money to replace a piece of apparatus that's not on the front line on a daily basis, or does it go on front line only type of basis?
Not usually. That's actually one of the misreads that people have within the guidance, as they say, you know, they follow Annex D within FBA 1901, and it's, you know, they say essentially 30-year-old trucks and 100,000 miles, but of course many trucks haven't reached that point mileage-wise in some areas. And people will read that and say, well, yeah, I've got a 52 pumper or mid-60s or, you know, it's however many years old, it's got a lot of miles on it, it's falling apart. And they think that it's going to be, you know, they meet the priority, so it's going to fly right through. And then they don't even make it past the computer scoring. When you have newer apparatus, the question is, you know, basically pessimistic is, okay, you know, if you've got a, you know, 2003 ladder truck and then you've got a 2001 pumper and a 1995 pumper on top of that 52, certainly the 52 would meet funding priorities if it was probably the only truck in your department. But basically the way it's looked at is you have two newer pumpers in your one station and a new ladder truck. And of course, if it was such a priority locally to replace that pump 52 pumper and get it off the road because it's unsafe to drive, then why was that ladder truck purchased instead of another pumper to replace that truck? Or why is it in service in the first place? If you have the call volume that you needed, three pumpers and a ladder truck, maybe they'll look at it as maybe you should have just, you know, bought a different ladder truck, or just replaced the pumper first and bought the ladder truck later. It's not necessarily about what you're exactly trying to replace. It's the entire situation at once. And that's another misconception people have with specific statistics that go into the application. Some people think that it's just, oh, the call volume that determines it, or your population, or how many members you have. It's not one specific number that's going to help you or hurt you. It's the conglomeration of everything together that helps build your statistical need, and that's what the computer scoring determines. And then of course the people that meet their needs more closely are the ones that will go on to peer review and have their narratives read and scored.
Brian, I'm not sure if this is something that does happen, but do you know of any departments who may plan out just to copy another department's grant from the previous year? For instance, a department, your neighboring department just won a grant for SCBA and you're trying to apply this year. Is it wise to just take their paperwork and change the name on it and resubmit it? Or do you really have to make sure it's dependent on your department itself?
That's actually pretty prevalent. There's very... as far as grant programs go, this is pretty new, only being in the sixth year, and there's very little information out there. There's lots of samples that people had out there, and people trading narratives as things to learn from, but many departments do just basically copy and paste and replace the name of the other department with their name and try and fit the situation. And essentially when that happens is you don't have an accurate reflection of your own needs. Sure, certainly you may need bunker gear, but you know, with only 32,000 departments in the country, it's kind of hard to expect that we're going to have that many identical departments with the same funding issues and same call volume and same budget. And of course, going back to the fact that, you know, we've got all those new projects and new players in the game every year, again, even if it didn't work for you one year or worked for you one year, it may not work the next. So of course, borrowing someone's previous application, whether it was awarded or not, isn't any kind of indicator that it's going to work the next year either. And one of the biggest things with taking narratives, I mean, there's certainly only a limited number of ways that you can explain the benefits of bunker gear or, you know, involve the national standards into a project. But, of course, your funding issues are different, and that's the biggest thing that people will copy and paste and say, well, that sounded good for them, so I'm going to try it for me. Well, of course, if it's not accurate, then the whole narrative may not make sense on why you haven't afforded it yet. And certainly in explaining what your needs are. Some people have actually copied and pasted an entire application and never even changed the names of the departments or the states or the cities. Certainly a couple have gone through where they mentioned, you know, the governor of South Carolina, but the department was in South Dakota.
Does that mean the application simply gets thrown out then, Brian?
It depends on how it was put together. if it was shown that they used an outside grant writer to make that application, the departments are responsible. That's the bottom line, is that this is a federal document. Of course, you can be charged with, you know, attempting to defraud the federal government for submitting a fraudulent application. But in a lot of cases, depending on the department, when they do an investigation, they'll figure out who did what and what goes on from there. If it was the department itself, they'll probably be barred from ever submitting a grant application again. They do determine that at the peer review time that, you know, they have a name of someone who prepared the application for them, they'll review the rest of it, and they'll assume that the department didn't know anything about it, and they'll make their best effort to try and review the situation based on what they can get out of the rest of the application and determine it from there. But in a lot of cases, yes, they do simply just throw out the application, and it's the same thing they do with ineligible projects anymore. They simply toss the application and don't even review it.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian. This program today was sponsored by PlimEvent. PlimEvent is a driving force in advancing firefighter health and safety. PlimEvent diesel exhaust removal system features 100% source capture to eliminate all diesel exhaust from the firehouse, as stated in the NFPA 1500 standard. PlimEvent exhaust removal systems meet the requirements stated in the Fire Act program guidance for modifications to facilities. Visit PlimEvent.com or click on the link on this page to learn more about their exhaust removal systems. Again, thank you very much, and please tune in for the next three parts here at Radio at Firehouse.com. Thank you.